bullet into him until he was riddled with them. Murderous beggars were those Turks who lined the heights of Tel el-Huelfa. Of course, had the memoirs of any of the Ottoman defenders at Tel el-Huelfa survived, they would have said the same of the British attackers. By 7 November, the Ottomans were in full retreat. Allenby's complex plan had achieved total success. His troops entered Gaza unopposed. Indeed, there was no one left in Gaza, where Ottoman soldiers had forcibly evicted the civilian population before the start of hostilities. British soldiers walked down narrow streets without a single house left standing, Gaza having been reduced to a ghost of a city. After losing their positions in Gaza, the Ottomans struggled to reform into a defensive line to stop the EEF before it reached Jerusalem. But the Yildirim group was still in the process of formation, and Allenby's army, at near full force, had built unstoppable momentum. The Anzac Mounted Division pursued the Ottomans up the Mediterranean coastline, while British forces succeeded in capturing a vital railway junction to the south of Jerusalem on 14 November. The following day, the Anzac Mounted Division occupied Ramla and Lida, and the Australian Mounted Division took Latrun. On 16 November, the New Zealand Brigade occupied the port of Jaffa. Isolated from the south and west, Jerusalem could not be defended. On 9 November, 2 days after Allenby's forces entered Gaza, the Jewish Chronicle published a new British policy on Palestine. In a brief letter to Walter Rothschild, dated 2 February, Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour issued the declaration that would come to bear his name. His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. The Balfour Declaration was an extraordinary commitment on the part of the British government. Its army had only just entered Palestine and was far from Jerusalem, and yet it felt sufficiently confident of success to make promises about what was still sovereign Ottoman territory. Of course, the British had been negotiating over Ottoman territory since the very start of the war. In that sense, the Balfour Declaration was but the latest in a string of wartime partition plans, beginning with the Constantinople Agreement of March 1915, the Hussein-McMahon correspondence of 1915 and 1916, and the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement. However, each of these previous partition plans had been kept secret. The Balfour Declaration was openly published in the London press. Moreover, in promising Britain's best endeavours to achieve the establishment for a national home for the Jews, Balfour seemed to be violating the terms of previous agreements with Sharif Hussein and the French government. To further complicate things, Sir Mark Sykes, architect of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, had lobbied the British government to lend its support to the Jewish national movement. It was Sykes who left the meeting of the British War Cabinet on 31 October 1917 to tell the Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann that the declaration had been approved. "Dr. Weizmann, it's a boy," Sykes famously announced to the anxious Weizmann waiting outside the War Cabinet's meeting room. Like the other partition plans for the Ottoman Empire, the Balfour Declaration was a product of wartime considerations. Note that it was the War Cabinet that approved the declaration, and it did so less to support Zionism than to harness Jewish influence to the British war effort. Weizmann and his supporters had succeeded in persuading influential members of the British cabinet that the Zionist movement spoke on behalf of not just a nationalist fringe among European Jews, but the political and economic might of the Jewish diaspora as a whole, the flip side of the old anti-Semitic myth of a clandestine Jewish international organization secretly controlling global finance. In supporting Zionism, members of the British government believed they would gain the support of influential Jews in the United States and Russia. America was a late entry into the war, its traditional isolationism making it a reluctant ally, and Russia's commitment to the war had been in doubt since the February Revolution and the Tsar's abdication in March 1917. Jews were believed to exercise significant influence over U.S. President Woodrow Wilson and over Prime Minister Alexander Kerensky's provisional government in Russia. If Jewish influence could keep these two powers actively engaged in the war, then it was in Britain's interest to court Jewish favor by supporting Zionism. Finally, many in the war cabinet wanted to revise the terms of earlier wartime agreements, particularly the Sykes-Picot Agreement. A growing number of influential voices believed Sykes had simply given too much to the French. The British had fought too hard for Palestine to hand the territory over to an ill-defined international administration at war's end. Furthermore, the British had learned from wartime experience how a hostile power in Palestine could threaten the security of the Suez Canal. At war's end, the British wanted to ensure that Palestine came under British administration. The Zionists were natural allies in that project, their political ambitions inconceivable without a great power's support. On the face of it, Lord Balfour was offering Palestine to the Zionist movement. In fact, Lloyd George's government was using the Zionist movement to secure Palestine for British rule. Jerusalem surrendered to the British on 9 December 1917. The Ottomans had made every effort to defend the city, yet Allenby's advance was relentless. Though his forces had been depleted by weeks of intense fighting, and his able-bodied men had been given only one day's leave on 17 November, he never left the Ottomans time to prepare their defences. He rightly reasoned his chances of success were higher and the risk of casualties lower if he pressed the Ottomans while they were on the run and demoralized by defeat. Both sides were averse to fighting in Jerusalem. Neither the British nor the Ottomans and Germans wanted to incur the international condemnation that would inevitably result from fighting in the holy city or damaging shrines sacred to Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. As British forces progressively secured the southern, western, and northern approaches to the city, the Ottomans and their German allies decided to withdraw to the east with the remainder of the Seventh Army intact. The retreat from Jerusalem began after sundown on 8 December and was completed overnight. By sunrise on 9 December, 401 years of Ottoman rule in Jerusalem had come to an end. The last act of the departing governor of Jerusalem was to draft a letter of surrender entrusting the holy city to the government of Great Britain. The governor left the letter with the mayor of Jerusalem, Hussein Selim el-Husseini, scion of one of the city's most respected families. The mayor, who spoke English, met with a number of British soldiers and officers too junior in rank to accept the city's surrender. Not until later in the afternoon was Major General Shea, authorized by Allenby, still at his headquarters in Jaffa, to accept the surrender of the city on his behalf. Allenby made his formal entry into Jerusalem on 11 December 1917. The War Office Cinematograph Committee filmed the carefully staged event to ensure the widest possible audience for the greatest victory of the war to date. This was, after all, Lloyd George's Christmas present for the British nation. Like Maud's declaration in Baghdad, Allenby's lines had been drafted for him in London and telegraphed to Palestine. The commander-in-chief of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force was even ordered to dismount before making his entry into the Holy City, a gesture of humility that would appeal to Christians in particular. The event was scripted not just for the benefit of onlookers in Jerusalem, but for the Prime Minister's announcement in the House of Commons. Lloyd George did not wish to squander the public relations coup and insisted on getting every detail of the historic moment right. As he entered Jerusalem, Allenby passed through an honour guard representing each of the nations whose soldiers had fought in Palestine, England, Wales, Scotland, India, Australia, and New Zealand. 20 French and 20 Italian soldiers represented Britain's Entente allies. Among the dignitaries in Allenby's entourage were T.E. Lawrence, who had come to discuss joint strategy between the Arab Revolt and the EEF, and Charles-François Georges Picot, joint author of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Allenby read the proclamation in English and looked on as it was read out in Arabic, Hebrew, French, Italian, Greek, and Russian from the foot of David's Tower. The speech was brief, Jerusalem was now under martial law, though its residents would be left to pursue their lawful business without fear of interruption, and the holy places of the three religions would be maintained and protected according to the existing customs and beliefs of those to whose faith they are sacred. To reinforce this point, Allenby then received the civil and religious dignitaries of the city, a parade of patriarchs, rabbis, muftis, and metropolitans in exotic robes and long beards. The film reel closes with shots of Jerusalem crowds jostling with the lines of soldiers, mule-drawn wagons, motorcycles and motorcars of the army of occupation. The fall of Jerusalem marked a major turning point in the Great War in the Middle East. By the end of 1917, the Ottomans had surrendered three cities of great symbolic value: Mecca, Baghdad, and Jerusalem. These losses, particularly the holy cities of Mecca and Jerusalem, had dealt the Ottoman jihad a severe blow. British officials in Egypt and India no longer feared reversals on the battlefield provoking religious fanaticism. More significantly, after victories over the British in Kut and Gaza, the Ottomans' lines in Mesopotamia and Palestine had been breached, and their armies driven into retreat by larger, better-provisioned British campaign forces. And the British in Palestine were now in touch with the Hashemite Arab army, which, following the occupation of Aqaba, was threatening Ottoman positions in the Syrian interior. By the end of 1917, the Ottomans had not been defeated, but their great war ambitions had been narrowed from victory to survival. 13. From Armistice to Armistice. In November 1917, the Bolsheviks seized power in Russia and sued for an immediate ceasefire with the Central Powers, an unimaginable reversal of fortunes that held the prospect of rescuing the Ottomans when their war effort, following the loss of Jerusalem, was at its nadir. The hardships of war had brought down the Russian monarchy in the February Revolution, a name based on the old Russian calendar. The events of the February Revolution actually took place in March 1917. Tsar Nicholas II abdicated on 15 March, and a provisional government headed by Alexander Kerensky assumed power. The Allies at first thought the revolution might revive the Russian war effort, though political upheaval undermined military discipline from the start. The first measure taken by the new government, Order No. 1 of 14 March 1917, was to strip Russian officers of their authority over the troops, who would be commanded thenceforth by elected soldier Soviets. Russian forces in occupied Ottoman territory were quick to comply, and chaos ensued. Long and repeated meetings of the Russian soldiers took place today as a result of the revolution in Petrograd. The American consul in the Black Sea port of Trabzon recorded in his political log on 23 March 1917. Excesses were feared as a result of the manifestations. Most of the shops were closed. After the election of an executive committee, composed mostly of soldiers, things became much quieter. Over the spring and summer months of 1917, an uneasy calm settled over the eastern Turkish lands occupied by the Russians. The shattered Ottoman Caucasus army, grateful for the respite, held its positions without firing a shot in anger for the rest of the year. Russian soldiers engaged in fierce political debates amongst themselves, their focus entirely on the homeland. Many questioned what they were doing on Ottoman territory at all. The Bolshevik Party resolved the soldiers' lingering doubts when it seized power on 7 November 1917, the October Revolution, by the old Russian calendar. Denouncing the war as an imperialist project, the Bolsheviks sued for a negotiated peace, without annexations and indemnities. The Young Turks could hardly believe their luck. Fear of Russian territorial ambitions in the Straits and Istanbul had driven the Ottoman Empire into its wartime alliance with Germany. In the course of the war, the Russian army had destroyed Ottoman defences in the Caucasus and occupied extensive territory in eastern Anatolia. Yet here was the new government of Russia, pledging to withdraw from the war as soon as possible and to abandon all territory gained in its course. The Young Turks met with representatives of the Russian Caucasus Army in the occupied city of Erzincan and concluded a formal armistice on 18 December. From the Black Sea to Lake Van, Russian and Ottoman soldiers laid down their arms, while their political leaders entered into negotiations for a peace treaty. In the Russian-occupied territories of eastern Anatolia, the armistice left a power vacuum. The Russian soldiers in Trabzon acted independently of their government in Petrograd. A democratically elected council of soldiers, workers, and peasants claimed full power and authority, but had no means to exercise either. The longer soldiers went without discipline and hierarchy, the more lawless and unruly they became. At the end of December 1917, Russian soldiers in Trabzon began to commandeer vessels to return home across the Black Sea. Many of the outgoing soldiers, who had gone months without pay, looted the town's shops to provide for their ride home. Martial law was declared on 31 December, without restoring security to the port. Disorder in the city was magnified in the surrounding countryside, where armed Turkish gangs drew ever closer as the Russians withdrew. Firing, pillaging, and panic are in the order of the day, the American consul reported at the end of January 1918. The Turkish bands are getting more audacious, and the Russian soldiers obnoxious. Whatever relief the armistice had brought to the Ottoman army, the towns under Russian occupation longed for the return of regular government that would only come with a peace treaty. The Central Powers met with representatives of the Bolshevik government in the German army headquarters at Brest-Litovsk. While the Russians hoped to recover territory lost to Germany and Austria, only the Ottomans stood to gain from the Bolsheviks' pledge of a peace without annexations. The Young Turks went to the peace table to seek not just the restoration of the 1914 borders, but to recover the Elvira y Shelase, the three provinces annexed by Russia in 1878, Kars, Ardahan, and Batum. After two rounds of inconclusive negotiations, the German army resumed hostilities against Russia and marched towards Petrograd on 18 February 1918. Defenseless before the German army, Vladimir Lenin instructed the Russian negotiators to conclude a peace deal with the Central Powers on whatever terms they could. The Russian hand thus weakened, the Ottomans secured the restoration of their 1914 borders and a full Russian evacuation from the three provinces, whose ultimate disposition would be determined by a public referendum to be organized by the Ottomans. The Young Turks were thus prime beneficiaries of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, signed on 3 March. The Ottoman government broke the news of the treaty to the Chamber of Deputies the day after it was signed. The politicians celebrated peace with Russia as a prelude to a general peace and the end of the war. The favorable terms of the treaty, restoring long-lost territories, compensated the Turkish nation for its horrendous wartime sacrifices. It also put to rest Russia's historic claims to Constantinople and the Straits. These gains combined to encourage hopes that the Ottomans might yet emerge from the Great War victorious. The Bolsheviks went to extraordinary lengths to discredit the policies of the deposed Tsar's government. Leon Trotsky, then People's Commissar of Foreign Affairs, published some of the Ancien Régime's dirtiest linen in the Soviet daily newspaper Izvestia in late November 1917. The most sensational item was the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the secret tripartite accord for the partition of the Ottoman Empire. Foreign correspondents in Moscow picked up the revelations and relayed them back to their eager editors at home. The Manchester Guardian first broke the news of the Sykes-Picot Agreement to the English-speaking world on 26 and 28 November. The Ottoman government seized on the revelations to denigrate the rebel Amir of Mecca, Sharif Hussein, and his son Faisal, commander of the Arab army. In a speech delivered in Beirut on 4 December 1917, just days before the fall of Jerusalem, Jamal Pasha divulged the terms of the Sykes-Picot Agreement to a stunned audience. Casting Sharif Hussein and his sons as the dupes of the British, he laid full responsibility for the enemy's arrival at the ramparts of Jerusalem on the leaders of the Arab revolt. Had there been some prospect, however remote, of his dreams of independence being realized, I might have conceded some speck of reason to the revolt in the Hejaz. But the real intentions of the British are now known. It has not taken them so very long to come to light. And thus will the Sharif Hussein be made to suffer the humiliation of having bartered the dignity conferred upon him by the Caliph of Islam for a state of enslavement to the British. The Ottoman government distributed copies of the speech in Arabic translation to the Syrian press, and the sensational news received wide coverage. Copies of the Beirut and Damascus newspapers were sent by rail to Medina and smuggled into Mecca to complete the Hashemites' humiliation. Sharif Hussein and his son Faisal were not totally unfamiliar with the Anglo-French partition plan. After all, Sir Mark Sykes and Pico had travelled to Jeddah earlier in the year to brief the Sharif and his son on the terms of their agreement. However, the British and French diplomats had been deliberately vague, knowing that full disclosure of their plans would put the Anglo-Arab alliance at risk. Sykes had led Sharif Hussein to believe that the British planned a short occupation of Iraq and would pay him rent for the time they remained there. He encouraged the Sharif to see France's presence in Syria as another such short-term lease in a small patch of the Syrian coastal region. The Sharif learned a great deal more about Anglo-French territorial ambitions from Jamal Pasha's speech than he had from his French and British allies. Jamal Pasha hoped to use the Sykes-Pico agreement to persuade the Hashemites to abandon their revolt and return to the Ottoman fold with all forgiven. Such a reconciliation would have a dramatic impact on the Ottoman position in Syria and Iraq. The now well-armed Arab forces the Sharif had recruited to fight the Ottomans could be turned against the British instead. Fahri Pasha's forces could be redeployed from Medina, and, combined with the Caucasus army now liberated from the Russian front by the armistice, used to recover Baghdad and Jerusalem from the British. By regaining Arab loyalties, the young Turks believed the Ottoman Empire stood a fighting chance of surviving the war. In December 1917, Jamal Pasha dispatched a letter to Faisal in Aqaba by secret courier. The young Turk leader offered full Arab autonomy within the Ottoman Empire, real autonomy instead of the foreign domination outlined by the Sykes-Pico agreement, in return for Hashemite loyalty. Faisal forwarded Jamal's letter to his father unanswered. The Sharif in turn sent the letter on to Sir Reginald Wingate, British High Commissioner in Egypt. Between the Balfour Declaration and the Sykes-Pico agreement, both published in November 1917, Sharif Hussein believed his British allies owed him an explanation. British officials in Egypt found themselves in an awkward position. They had played no part in the secret partition plans they now had to answer for on behalf of His Majesty's government. The stakes were high, as these awkward disclosures endangered British campaigns in Mesopotamia and Palestine, and threatened to destroy the Anglo-Hashemite alliance and the Arab revolt just as it was gaining momentum. The head of the Arab Bureau in Cairo, Commander D.G. Hogarth, addressed the Sharif's concerns about the Balfour Declaration in a message dated January 1918. He reaffirmed the Allies' determination that the Arab race shall be given full opportunity of once again forming a nation in the world, and that no people shall be subject to another in Palestine. However, world Jewish opinion favoured a return of Jews to Palestine, and the British government supported that aspiration. World Jewry, Hogarth assured his Arab ally, had a political influence in many states, and the friendship Jews tendered the Arabs was not one to be lightly thrown aside. Wingate sought the Foreign Office's advice before responding to the Sharif's questions about the Sykes-Pico agreement. London replied on 8 February 1918 with classic diplomatic double talk. The British government thanked the Sharif for sending Jamal's letter, dismissed it as a transparent bid to sow doubt and suspicion between the Hashemites and the Allied powers, and reaffirmed His Majesty's government's pledge in regard to the liberation of the Arab peoples. The Sharif might have been concerned that the British neither confirmed nor denied the contents of the partition plans, but he and his sons had gone too far in their revolt against the Ottomans to turn back now. Jamal's letter to Sharif Hussein went unanswered. Clinging to every British statement reconfirming their support for Arab independence, Sharif Hussein and his sons persisted in their struggle against the Ottoman Empire, hoping to secure by military success what the British and French seemed intent on denying them through their secret diplomacy. Since the Ottoman surrender in Aqaba in July 1917, The main theatre of the Arab revolt had shifted from the Hejaz to the southern frontiers of Syria. Here, Faisal continued to build up his regular army under the command of Ja'far al-Askari and to recruit fresh tribal irregulars. The British and French, assisted by colonial forces from Egypt and Algeria, provided technical expertise and modern firepower. A squad of armoured cars, a flight of airplanes, and a battery of 10-pound guns gave the Arab army the latest military technology to bombard Turkish lines. From Aqaba, Faisal's army confronted the strong Ottoman garrison at Ma'an. One of the pilgrimage stations between Damascus and Mecca, Ma'an traditionally marked the boundary between Syria and the Hejaz. It was one of the larger stations on the Hejaz Railway and housed a major garrison. In August 1917, T.E. Lawrence had estimated the Ottomans had 6,000 infantry, a regiment of cavalry and mounted infantry, and had entrenched Ma'an until it was impregnable according to the standard of manoeuvre war. It was not the sort of position that Faisal's guerrilla army stood a chance of taking. Faced with the pressure to advance northward as General Sir Edmund Allenby's right flank, the Arab army initially bypassed Ma'an to seize the highlands dominating the Jordan Valley. Led by Faisal's youngest brother, Zayd, the Sharifian detachment captured the castle town of Shaubach and occupied the Ottoman administrative centre Tafila unopposed on 15 January 1918. The commander of the local garrison, Zaki el-Halabi, deserted from Ottoman service along with his 240 soldiers to join forces with the Arab army. The Turkish army, unreconciled to the loss of Tafila, made a determined bid to recover the hilltop town on 26 January, but was repulsed, with heavy losses, by the Sharifian detachment and its new allies. Tafila was to change hands twice in the next 6 weeks, with the Ottomans recovering the town on 6 March, before surrendering it to the Arabs again on 18 March. In Palestine, the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, EEF, resumed its offensive. Britain's Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, had instructed Allenby to renew hostilities in Palestine in February 1918 and to deal the Ottoman Empire a decisive blow to force it out of the war. Rather than advance deeper into Palestine, Allenby decided to make his attack in the east. His objective was Amman, across the River Jordan, where he hoped to join forces with the Arab army and sever the Ottomans' vital rail link to both Ma'an and Medina. With an estimated 20,000 Turkish troops to the south of Amman, Allenby wanted to neutralize the threat on his right flank before making his final push on to Damascus. As a first step, Allenby chose to occupy the town of Jericho in the Jordan Valley to serve as an advance base for operations in Transjordan. On 19 February, Allenby's forces began a slow and deliberate march down the steep slopes of the Jordan Valley towards Jericho. The narrow tracks were impassable to wheeled traffic, and the line of infantry and cavalry extended over 5 miles. Turkish gunners slowed but did not stop the British advance, and Allenby's forces entered Jericho on the morning of 21 February. Their imaginations fired by biblical accounts of Joshua and the walls of Jericho, the Anzac cavalrymen were quickly brought back to earth. Of all the cities of the east that our men had passed through, one New Zealand cavalry officer recalled, Jericho easily led the way as the filthiest and most evil-smelling of them all. Before crossing the Jordan, Allenby secured a safety cordon along his northern Palestine front. The EEF advanced 7 miles northward to take control of the high ground around the Wadi Auja, one of the watercourses to the Jordan River. In so doing, the British put their operations in Jericho beyond the reach of Ottoman artillery and forced the Turks into a long detour should they seek to reinforce their positions in Transjordan with troops from Palestine. Beginning 8 March, the operation took 4 days. The Ottomans grudgingly withdrew to avoid a major engagement. With British forces holding a secure line from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, Allenby prepared to invade Transjordan. The British commanders coordinated their invasion plans with their Arab allies. With Lieutenant Colonel Alan Dorney, head of the newly created Hejaz Operations Staff, serving as the liaison to Sharifian forces, Allenby's plan called for the Arab army to attack Ma'an to pin down the garrison there while the EEF seized Amman. Faisal met with his officers to agree on their plan of action. One force would attack the Hijaz railway south of Ma'an and destroy the rails. A second force would do the same to the railway north of Ma'an. Ja'far el-Askari would lead the main body of the Arab army in a direct assault on Ottoman positions in Ma'an, which would be cut off from the twice-severed railway line and impossible to reinforce. In this way, the garrison in Ma'an would pose no threat to British operations further north in Oman. T.E. Lawrence was to make contact with Allenby's forces in Transjordan and bring the powerful Bani Sakha tribe to reinforce British positions against the Turks. These ambitious plans relied on each party fulfilling its role on a timely basis, for there were no communications between the different forces. The British had introduced carrier pigeons into the theatre, but there was no way of coordinating actions between the different units of the Arab army operating over a 50-mile stretch of the Hijaz railway, let alone between the Arabs and the British, separated by hundreds of miles of open land. When things went wrong, the Allies only learned of each other's setbacks at the speed of a horseman. Rumour and disinformation added to the fog of war. The Arab assault on Ma'an was a washout. Unseasonably cold rains drenched southern Transjordan in March 1918. Ja'far el-Askari, who accompanied the raiding party tasked with destroying the railway south of Ma'an, recalled how a torrential downpour soaked us to the skin and further progress became impossible. Camels and pack animals were floundering in mud, and our men were so beset that during the night some of them died of exposure to the bitter cold and rain. In the end, the attack on Ma'an was postponed, pending more favourable conditions. Unaware of the Arab army's problems around Ma'an, British troops crossed the Jordan on 21 March. They advanced up the steep tracks from the Jordan Valley towards the Transjordanian highlands and the town of Salt. Seat of an Ottoman district governor, Salt was the largest town to the east of the Jordan, with a population of some 15,000 Muslims and Christians. As they approached the town on 25 March, the British paused at the sound of relentless gunfire. Rather than the battle they had imagined, the advance guard found the townsmen firing in the air, celebrating the Ottoman withdrawal as they looted the Ottoman municipality. "They had stripped the building bare," one astonished soldier recorded in his diary. "Even the roof and all woodwork, leaving only the walls standing." The natives of Salt believed the British occupation spelled the end of their war and revelled in what would prove short-lived freedoms. The Ottomans had withdrawn from Salt without a fight to regroup for the defence of Oman. The new commander of the Yildirim group in Palestine and Transjordan was none other than Otto Lehmann von Sanders, who since 1913 had headed the German military mission to the Ottoman Empire. His experience proved a great asset, and the respect he showed his Ottoman officers and soldiers was reciprocated with a high degree of trust. Lehmann needed the full cooperation of his Ottoman troops. Were the British to seize Amman with its strategic rail facilities, Ottoman positions further south on the Hijaz railway would be untenable, leaving 20,000 troops in Medina and Ma'an in total isolation. Amman was a fight to the death for Turkish forces in both the Hijaz and Transjordan. Lehmann responded to news of the British occupation of Salt by calling up all available troops to Amman. Disruptions on the railway line slowed their movement, but hundreds of reinforcements from Damascus began to flood into Amman. Some 900 men entrained from Ma'an, their movement unhindered by any Arab operations. Turkish cavalry in Palestine forded the Jordan River upstream from British positions to threaten their line of communications. The British planned to secure their position in Salt with infantry and to attack Amman with cavalry. Their objectives were a viaduct and tunnel near Amman that, once destroyed, would disrupt rail travel for months. A strong infantry detachment, based in Salt, would then prevent Ottoman repair teams from making good the damage and would threaten communications between Damascus and the garrisons south of Amman. If the British were successful, the Ottomans would be forced to retreat north of Amman, effectively abandoning Medina and the southern half of Transjordan to the Hashemites. As they advanced from Salt towards Amman on 27 March, the British encountered the same bad weather that had hindered Arab operations further south. The movement of animals and men was slowed over ground reduced to mudslicks, impossible to wield traffic. Guns and ammunition were transferred from wagons to camels to be transported to the front. Even camels could barely get over this ground on which they were constantly slipping, Lehman recorded. We intercepted a British wireless message complaining of this condition. By monitoring British radio communications, the Germans had a good sense of British plans and organized their defenses accordingly. The 2,000 Ottoman defenders took up positions dominating every point of entry into Amman. Armed with 70 machine guns and 10 artillery pieces in well-sheltered positions, they enjoyed the defenders' advantage in trench warfare. The 3,000 British troops approached Amman wet and tired after a march in which several Britons died of exposure. The rains had prevented British artillery from reaching the front, and their supplies of machine guns and ammunition had been reduced to what could be transported by camel, many of which perished on the steep valley tracks made treacherous by the rains. For 3 days the Turks held off determined assaults by EEF cavalry and infantry. Fighting in the same adverse weather as the British attackers, the Turks also suffered heavy casualties and began to flag. To counter any defeatism among his frontline troops, Lehman von Sanders gave orders for resistance to the last regardless. He reminded his officers that fresh reinforcements were arriving daily from Damascus and Ma'an to help them weather the storm. Though the Turks believed their situation was critical, the invaders were in a far worse position. The Anzac cavalrymen, drenched from the relentless rains and sleeping in the open air, suffered from the intense cold. The rain-slicked paths were nearly impassable to horses and camels, making it ever harder for the British to supply advanced troops with ammunition and rations. It also proved increasingly difficult to evacuate the growing number of wounded. After days of intense combat, the Turks showed no sign of giving up. Moreover, the British line of retreat was threatened by Turkish cavalrymen who harried their positions on the Jordan River and in Salt. By mid-afternoon on 30 March, the British commanders acknowledged they were unable to take Amman and ordered a full retreat. The Ottomans pursued the retreating British forces from Amman back to Salt. As the British began to evacuate their wounded and pack their stores, panic swept Salt's townspeople. The plundered shell of the government building stood as a monument to their disloyalty to the Ottoman Empire, and they knew they faced certain retribution when the Turks returned. Some 5,500 Christians and 300 Muslims abandoned their homes to retreat with the British to Jerusalem. A British soldier captured in his diary their misery amidst the chaos of the British retreat. One young man is carrying his grandfather on his back. He carries him 13 miles. Women and men and children are bent nearly double under the tremendous bundles, and they cap the lot with a saucepan or washing bowl on their heads. Bullocks get in the way of armoured cars, camels stumble over overloaded donkeys. The British press declared the Amman raid a success. The soldiers who fought in the engagement, having lost 200 dead and 1,000 wounded, knew better. As one New Zealand cavalryman summed it up, the damage done to the enemy hardly justified the heavy British casualties suffered. Headlines trumpeting success made the press reports, in the light of knowledge of the truth, seemed more or less facetious. As British forces withdrew from Transjordan, Faisal's army resumed operations against Ma'an. The Ottomans' recent redeployment of troops for the defence of Amman had reduced the strength of the garrison in Ma'an, improving the Arab army's chances of a breakthrough against the nearly impregnable town. The plan, once again, was to sever Ma'an from the north and south, before mounting a direct assault on the town centre. Jafar al-Askari, chief of staff of the Arab army, led the assault on the northern railway station of Jarduna on 12 April. He had under his command an infantry battalion, one artillery piece, and 400 Bedouin cavalry. They approached the station at dawn and opened fire with their 18-pound field gun. The advancing infantry came under intense gunfire from the defenders. Askari kept waiting for his Bedouin cavalry to attack and relieve the infantry. He found them milling about aimlessly in dead ground, and stirred them to action with an impassioned harangue, pointing out that their comrades would be slain unless they came to their rescue with a diversionary assault. The tribesmen then stormed the station and forced the 200 defenders to surrender. They looted the station, seizing weapons, ammunition, and military supplies. T.E. Lawrence and Hubert Young appeared later in the evening to blow the railway bridge to the south of Jarduna, cutting Ma'an off from the north. That same night, Nuri el-Said led an attack on the Ghada al-Hajj railway station to the south of Ma'an. Muhammad Ali al-Ajluni commanded one of the infantry companies in the attack on the station. Their force was divided by personal grievances between two of the officers, and Ajluni, like Askari, was forced to deliver an impassioned harangue to restore order to the raiding party. A French artillery battery and a machine gun team provided support, along with several hundred Bedouin horsemen commanded by the famous Auda Abu Tayy of the Hawitot. As in Jarduna, the raiders struck at dawn, with their artillery bombarding the station for 2 hours. Most of the defenders surrendered early in the day, but one trench of Ottoman soldiers held out for hours before finally surrendering. The deep hatreds provoked by the Arab revolt surfaced at Ghadir el-Hajj. One of the Arab commanders confronted the 300 Ottoman prisoners with an atrocity committed against a captain in his unit, who had allegedly been tortured and burned alive by his Turkish captors. The commander ordered the Ottoman prisoners to select 4 of their own ranks to be executed, to avenge the terrible death of his captain. Before he could proceed, the other Arab officers intervened to ensure the POWs received humane treatment. The raiding party then resumed its work, destroying 5 bridges and some 900 yards of track, cutting Ma'an from the south. With Ma'an's links to the outside world severed, the Arab army began an assault on the garrison town itself. On 13 April, they occupied the high ground to the west of Ma'an at Simna. 2 days later, they stormed the railway station in what proved the bloodiest encounter of the Arab revolt. The battle for control of the station dragged on for 4 days, with heavy casualties on both sides. Jafar al-Askari bitterly condemned the French artillery battery, commanded by Captain Rosario Pisani of the French mission to the Hijaz, which ran out of ammunition on the first day of fighting, actually after the first hour of fighting, by Askari's account. The Arab commander had little faith in his French allies, whom he accused of supporting France's share of the Sykes-Picot agreement more energetically than the Arab war effort. Captain Pisani used to remind us incessantly that he would be able to accompany us no farther than the Syrian frontier, and that the French would not assist the Arabs beyond that point, Askari remembered. Pisani's declarations were doubtless a reflection of France's bad intentions. T.E. Lawrence, an eyewitness to the battle for Ma'an, gave Pisani the benefit of the doubt. "We found Pisani wringing his hands in despair every round expended," Lawrence wrote. "He said he had implored Nuri not to attack at this moment of his penury." Amir Faisal later telegraphed his thanks to the French Ministry of War for the good work of French troops in Ma'an, expressing his hopes that all artillerymen will receive their reward. The leader of the Arab revolt was more diplomatic than his Arab officers. After 3 days of heavy fighting, Arab forces had managed to capture 3 lines of Turkish trenches around Ma'an. The Ottoman commanders knew that with the railway line cut, they would receive no reinforcements or fresh ammunition. Some of the officers called for a fight to the last man. Others wanted to open negotiations with the Arab army to discuss terms of surrender. The townspeople of Ma'an, knowing the Bedouin fighting with Faisal would pillage their homes and shops, stiffened the Ottoman resolve to fight. 500 townsmen joined forces with the Ottomans on the 4th day, and renewed the battle with determination against the exhausted Arab army. By the 4th day of battle, the Arab army was shattered. Its soldiers had gone without artillery cover for days, while being strafed and bombarded by Ottoman machine guns and artillery. Their Bedouin cavalry had withdrawn 2 days earlier in what the regular infantry saw as a vote of no confidence. With over half their officers dead or wounded, discipline among the regular soldiers was breaking down. Reluctantly, Askari called for a retreat. Their losses at Ma'an, over 90 Arab dead and 200 wounded, though paltry by the standards of the Western Front, were the worst the Arabs had yet suffered in the revolt. Faced with a defeat of unprecedented magnitude, Amir Faisal and his chief of staff struggled to rebuild morale in their broken army. Faisal gave the army a rousing speech, and Ja'far al-Askari reminded his men that a retreat was not a defeat, and that once they had sufficient artillery, they would resume their victorious course and take Ma'an. These speeches helped to restore morale among the Syrians and Iraqis in the regular army, according to one of the officers present. But the damage to Hashemite prestige in Transjordan would not be restored for some time. On 21 March 1918, Germany had achieved a major breakthrough on the Western Front. Peace with Russia had enabled the Central Powers to redeploy forces from the Eastern Front to the West, giving them a decisive local numerical advantage over the Entente Powers. German commanders decided to act before the United States, which had entered the war the previous year, had sent sufficient forces to redress the balance of power. Operation Michael targeted a relatively weak point in the British line at Saint-Quentin. After an overpowering artillery barrage, German forces attacked, sweeping the British before them. By the end of the first day of fighting, the Germans had advanced 8 miles and occupied nearly 100 square miles of French territory. These gains came at a price, and the Germans suffered heavy casualties. However, British losses were alarming. Over 38,000 by the end of the day, including 21,000 taken prisoner. The EEF felt the consequences of Germany's spring offensive almost immediately. On 27 March, the British War Cabinet ordered Allenby to adopt an active defence in Palestine and to prepare his infantry divisions for immediate dispatch to France. By mid-1918, some 60,000 experienced infantrymen had been sent from Egypt and Palestine to France. They were replaced by fresh recruits from India, inexperienced soldiers who needed extensive training before they would be ready for battle. Before going on active defence and shipping his best troops to France, Allenby made one last bid on Transjordan. Given the tight constraints, the campaign was ill-timed and misconceived. To all appearances, Allenby sent his men into a trap. Allenby's plan called for his cavalry to secure the key fords across the Jordan River and to protect three of the main tracks leading from the Jordan Valley to the Amman Plateau. Mounted troops were then to scale the valleys to reoccupy Salt. After securing their positions in Salt from counterattack, the Anzac cavalry were to gallop back down the Jordan Valley to attack the Turkish garrison at Shunat Nimrin from the rear, forcing its surrender. Allenby's men had negotiated with the powerful Bani Sakhr tribes to block the crucial fourth track between the Jordan Valley and the Amman Plateau to complete the encirclement of Ottoman forces between Salt and the Jordan Valley. From this strong position, British forces would be well placed to occupy Amman and the High Plateau. Allenby's officers thought his plans impracticable. General Sahari Chovel, commander of the Desert Mounted Corps, believed the Ottomans anticipated the attack. Given frequent German intercepts of British wireless communications, this was probably true. The Bedouin might also have revealed British plans to the Ottomans. Chovel was very uncomfortable with the prominent role Allenby's plan assigned to the Bedouin. The Australian general did not believe the tribesmen were sufficiently reliable to count on in the heat of battle. In fact, the Bani Sakhr were among the tribes of Transjordan whose loyalties were divided between the Hashemites and the Ottomans. If Allenby's men had negotiated with a branch of the Bani Sakhr that leaned to the Ottomans, their plans would have been leaked directly to Lehman von Saunders. Two things make treachery by the Bani Sakhr seem likely. First, the tribesmen played a key role in setting the date for Allenby's attack, arguing that they would only be available to cut the route to Shunat Nimrin until 4 May. Their reasons for this seemingly arbitrary date ring hollow. They claimed they would need to change encampments to resupply after that date. In forcing Allenby to launch his attack by a specific date and earlier than he had planned, the Bani Sakhr seemed to be working to the Ottomans' advantage. More damning still, the Bani Sakhr failed to materialize on the agreed date to block the strategic track to Shunat Nimrin, condemning the British plan to failure before it had even begun. The first Australian cavalry units crossed the Jordan before sunrise on 30 April and took up the positions assigned to them in the battle plan. By 8:30, word of the attack reached Lehman von Zanders, who unleashed a counterattack that caught the invaders completely by surprise. Lehman had managed to deploy significant new reinforcements in Palestine, including a cavalry brigade from the Caucasus and several German infantry units in total secrecy. The Germans and Ottomans had also assembled and hidden a pontoon bridge for the rapid deployment of these troops between the west and east banks of the Jordan. On Lehman's command, these forces began to cross the River Jordan to challenge the invaders. Suddenly outnumbered, Allenby's mounted forces surrendered two of the four tracks leading from the Jordan Valley to Salt. The Shunat-Nimrin track remained open to Turkish traffic, with no sign of the Bani Sakha. That left only one track in British hands for their forces to reach or retreat from Salt. And that route was in imminent risk of being cut off by Ottoman and German forces far stronger than Allenby had anticipated. Fresh troops were sent across the Jordan to help secure the EEF's beleaguered positions. They engaged in heavy fighting with Ottoman forces, who threatened to cut off and defeat the British force. After 4 days, with ammunition and rations running low, Chauvel requested Allenby's permission to retreat. Salt was abandoned for the second time, and by midnight on 4 May, all surviving forces had crossed safely back into Palestine. But the EEF had lost 214 men killed and nearly 1,300 wounded. As one British soldier concluded, the second S. Salt stunt was a complete muck-up. In the 5 months after the fall of Jerusalem, the Ottomans had enjoyed an astonishing recovery. Peace with Russia had restored lost territory in eastern Anatolia and eliminated military threats in both the Caucasus and Mesopotamia. The revelation of secret wartime partition agreements had discredited the British, French, and Hashemites. The Yildirim group had effectively contained attacks by the Arab army in Ma'an and two attempts by Allenby's army on Amman. And with the German spring offensive breaking through British and French lines on the Western Front, the Ottomans seemed to be on the winning side of the Great War. The impact on public opinion in Transjordan was dramatic. In Salt, townspeople volunteered to join the Ottoman army. As a French intelligence agent reported, the headmen in the villages are registering numerous volunteers who present themselves for military service. The inhabitants say, if the English had to withdraw from Salt, when faced with such insignificant Turkish forces, they will not be able to make any further advances since the Ottoman forces are growing. This is why we must preserve good relations with the Turks and win their sympathy. Trust in Faisal's army had also been shaken. His appeals to the tribes of central Transjordan went unanswered. As a native agent for the French intelligence service explained, the Arabs would have responded to Faisal in the following terms. You took Tafila and you withdrew. The English took Salt twice and withdrew. If we declare war on the Turks, we worry that, after massacring the troops now among us, you will abandon us. As Allenby saw off his experienced soldiers and received his new drafts, he was forced to defer further action in Palestine until the autumn at the very earliest. The only positive result for the EEF, after a spring of disastrous campaigns, was that the two attempts on Amman had encouraged the Ottomans to draw down their forces in Palestine to reinforce their positions in Transjordan. This was to Allenby's advantage, as the EEF's final push would be in Palestine, not Transjordan. As the Ottomans contained Allenby's forces in Palestine, Enver Pasha launched a desperate bid to reinforce the empire's position in the Caucasus. Following the peace treaty with Russia signed at Brest-Litovsk in March 1918, Enver and his colleagues saw a window of opportunity to regain lost territory while Russia was weak with revolution and civil war. Although no longer at war with Russia, Enver never had more need for his soldiers on the Eastern Front. Already in February 1918, the Ottoman army had moved to reclaim territory occupied by the Russians in the course of the war. The power vacuum in Trabzon was finally resolved on 24 February, when Ottoman troops entered the city without a fight. Quite the contrary, a Russian brass band was on hand to welcome their arrival. The energetic Turkish forces swept on towards Erzurum, which they stormed on 11 March. The short ration Turkish soldiers marvelled at the supplies the Russians had left behind, more than enough to feed the army as it pressed on towards the Ottomans' 1914 frontiers, which they reached on 24 March. As the Turks moved beyond the 1914 frontiers to stake their claim to the three provinces ceded to Russia in 1878 but recovered at Brest-Litovsk, they faced a dilemma. On the one hand, they sought the restoration of Ottoman territory as a matter of national priority. Yet encouraging the creation of buffer states between their empire and Russia was in the Ottomans' interest. Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, three relatively weak new states to emerge following the collapse of the Russian Empire, would be safer neighbours than the Russian giant. The challenge was to recover former Ottoman territories, Batum in Georgia, Kars and Ardahan in Armenia, without destabilizing their new neighbours on the Caucasus frontier. Turkish troops entered Batum on 19 April and occupied Kars on 25 April. They went to work preparing the plebiscite that, in accordance with the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, would legitimate their annexation to the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman army organized the vote, overseen by a committee of Turkish civil servants, and achieved predictable results from the all-male electorate, a 97.5% vote in favour of the incorporation of the provinces into the Ottoman Empire. The process was formalised by imperial decree on 11 August 1918, in which Sultan Mehmed VI Fahiyeddin acceded to the wishes of the region's people to return to the divinely protected lands of the Ottoman Empire. When the Ottomans went beyond the three provinces to make a bid for the Azeri capital of Baku, they faced hostility from their German allies, the Bolsheviks and the British alike. Oil-rich Baku was the greatest prize of the Caucasus. The Germans had set their sights on the Caspian city since the start of the war, and in the summer of 1918 needed its oil resources more than ever. The British, advancing through Persia, were determined to deny Baku to both the Germans and their Ottoman allies. The Bolsheviks held tenuous control over Baku through a violent revolutionary regime shared with the Armenian nationalist Dashnak party known as the Baku Commune. In March 1918, the Commune's forces had unleashed a pogrom against the Azeri Muslim majority, killing up to 12,000 Muslims. Half the surviving Muslim population fled the city for the relative safety of the countryside. When the Azeri Muslims appealed for help, Enver Pasha was quick to take up their cause and to extend Ottoman influence over Caspian oil. The Ottomans and Azeris concluded a treaty of friendship and alliance on 4 June 1918. The Azeris sought Ottoman assistance to liberate their territories from the Bolsheviks' control and requested Turkish military assistance. The Germans bristled at their Turkish allies' advance towards Baku. Following events from Berlin, Germany's military rulers, Erich Ludendorff and Paul von Hindenburg, advised Enver to withdraw his forces back to the frontiers recognized at Brest-Litovsk and to redeploy the Caucasus divisions to the Arab fronts, where they were more urgently needed. Enver blithely disregarded their advice and pressed on. While all was calm in Palestine, Enver seized the opportunity to secure Ottoman interests in a rapidly changing geopolitical game. From Baku, Enver reasoned, he would deploy his forces southward towards Mesopotamia and retake Baghdad. To spearhead the liberation of Baku, Enver created a corps of Caucasian volunteers called the Caucasus Army of Islam. He appointed his half-brother Nuri Pasha, who had served with Jafar el-Askari in the 1915-1916 Senussi campaign in the Western Desert, to lead this volunteer force. Given the tepid response to Nuri Pasha's efforts at recruitment, Enver was forced to transfer an Ottoman infantry division to reinforce the Caucasus Army of Islam. A first attempt to occupy Baku on 5 August was driven back by Bolshevik artillery and the sudden appearance of a British detachment. Nuri urgently requested reinforcements, and Enver dispatched two more Ottoman regiments to assist in the conquest of Baku. They finally took the city on 15 September, not to add Baku to the Ottoman Empire, but to ensure that the new state of Azerbaijan would become a loyal client in the post-Tsarist Caucasus. Enver succeeded in recovering Ottoman territory in the Caucasus and in shaping the new states bordering eastern Anatolia to Ottoman advantage. Had the Ottomans won the Great War, he might have been celebrated as a visionary statesman for securing his country's eastern frontiers. However, within days of the Ottoman entry into Baku, Allenby's forces broke through Ottoman lines in Palestine. For having diverted Turkish troops away from more critical fronts in Mesopotamia and Palestine, Enver's Caucasus campaign is remembered instead as a rash initiative that contributed to the fall, rather than the preservation, of the Ottoman Empire. By the summer of 1918, Allied forces on the Western Front had ground the German breakthrough down to a halt. Whitehall once again encouraged Allenby to renew his offensive on the Ottoman front, so long as he could manage with his existing resources. By mid-July, Allenby informed the War Office that he planned to resume operations in the autumn. The commander of the EEF then began to plan in earnest. Allenby was a master of deception. In the Battle of Beersheba, 31 October 1917, he had made every effort to convince the Ottomans he planned a third attempt on Gaza, and, in so doing, encouraged his enemy to weaken his defences just where Allenby planned to attack. Now, to cover his plans for a major assault on Ottoman positions on the Mediterranean coast of Palestine, Allenby made a great show of planning a third attack on Amman. While his troops were not engaged in basic training to prepare them for the approaching campaign, Allenby had them building life-size models of horses in wood and canvas, 15,000 in all. Little by little, under cover of darkness, he began to transfer cavalry and infantry units from the Jordan Valley and the Judean hills to the coast, where they were billeted in camouflaged tents to prevent German aircraft from observing them. The wood and canvas remounts were left to take the place of the real horses, while soldiers drove mule-drawn sleighs across the dry ground of the Jordan Valley to simulate the dust of cavalry manoeuvres. Engineers threw new bridges across the Jordan, and radio signals were broadcast from deserted headquarters. The Arab army played a key role in focusing Ottoman attention on Transjordan. Jafar el-Askari's regular army had reached a strength of over 8,000 men, reinforced by British armoured cars, French artillery, Egyptian camel corps, and Australian and British airplanes. Sharif Nasser had rallied thousands of Bedouin irregulars sworn to support the Arab revolt. In early September, while Askari and the bulk of his army remained in position surrounding Ma'an, a 1,000-man detachment of the Arab army was posted in al-Azraq, an oasis 50 miles east of Amman. Their sudden appearance helped feed rumours of an impending Arab attack on Amman, when in fact Faisal's forces had been assigned the task of cutting the railway lines at the key junction of Daraa, where the Hejaz railway joined the Haifa spur. The Royal Air Force launched aerial attacks on Daraa on 16 September in a bid to disrupt Ottoman communications and to encourage Lehman von Zanders to focus on the defence of the Hejaz railway. T.E. Lawrence led Arab forces in an attack with armoured cars on the railway south of Daraa, where they succeeded in destroying a bridge. The following day, the main Arab force attacked the railway to the north of Daraa with relative impunity. The Ottomans rushed to repair the line, and Lehman called up reserves from the coastal port of Haifa to reinforce Daraa, playing perfectly into Allenby's deception. In his determination to keep the details of the attack secret, Allenby waited until just 3 days before zero hour to brief his brigade and regimental commanders on the actual objectives of the offensive. By that time, he had managed to concentrate some 35,000 infantry and 9,000 cavalry, supported by nearly 400 heavy artillery, on a 15-mile front on the Mediterranean just north of Jaffa. The Turks had no more than 10,000 men and 130 guns defending the coastline, while their positions in Transjordan were heavily reinforced in anticipation of an imminent attack. 2 days before the attack was launched, an Indian soldier deserted British lines for the Ottoman trenches. Under questioning by Ottoman and German officers, he revealed everything he knew about the impending campaign, that the British intended to breach Ottoman lines on the Mediterranean in an attack beginning 19 September, which, Lehmann recorded, the deserter wanted to escape. But Allenby's deception was so thorough that Lehmann and his officers dismissed the deserter's account as deliberate disinformation. The massing of Arab troops in El Azraq and the attacks on Daraa convinced Lehmann the Allies were determined to sever his main line of communications, the Hejaz Railway, and he further reinforced his positions in Transjordan. Shortly before dawn on 19 September, the British revealed their true intentions with an intense artillery bombardment of Ottoman trenches north of Jaffa. For many of the new Indian soldiers, their first experience of battle was overwhelming, with the massed cannons firing at the rate of 1,000 shells per minute. The fire of the artillery and the machine guns was very heavy, a Sikh soldier wrote to his father. Our ears could hear nothing, and in that place brother could not recognize brother. The very earth was forced to quake. As soon as the artillery barrage ended, British and Indian infantry stormed the devastated Ottoman trenches. After some hand-to-hand fighting in the third and fourth lines of defence, those Turks who could retreat did, and the rest surrendered. In the first 2.5 hours of operations, the infantry had broken through Turkish lines and advanced 7,000 yards, clearing the way for the cavalry to invade northern Palestine. Anzac and Indian cavalry units flooded through the breach made by the infantry and began a series of manoeuvres designed to encircle the Ottoman 7th and 8th armies and seize key towns. One of their first targets was the crossroads of Tulkarm. Tawfiq el-Suwaidi, who as a student in Paris before the war had helped to organize the 1913 Arab Congress, was serving as an officer with a desk job in Tulkarm when the battle erupted. He and his comrades woke, in a panic, to the sounds of the artillery bombardment. He climbed to the rooftop and could see the exchange of artillery about 10 miles away, a dreadful band of fire all the way down the front as each side bombarded the other with unrelenting ferocity. Shortly after sunrise, retreating Ottoman soldiers flooded Tulkarm, and British forces appeared from everywhere, taking the remnants of the Turkish army captive. As British aircraft bombed Tulkarm, the civilians fled the town in terror. Suwaidi retreated with them to a neighbouring village, where he took off his officer's uniform and dressed in the clothes of a Palestinian peasant. With this simple gesture, Suwaidi joined the swelling ranks of deserters from the Ottoman army. Remaining in British-occupied territory while Turkish forces retired in disorder, Suwaidi abandoned the Ottoman Great War and dreamed of returning home to Baghdad. The British cavalry raced across northern Palestine, securing key towns and crossroads to complete the encirclement of the Ottoman 7th and 8th armies, the backbone of the once formidable Yildirim group. At dawn on 20 September, Baysan and Afula were in British hands. Bombing raids by the Royal Air Force and the Australian Flying Corps had destroyed Ottoman telephone lines. With their communications down, Turkish and German officers had no warning of British advances or of Ottoman losses. 24 hours after the start of operations, Lehmann was surprised in his Nazareth headquarters by the sudden appearance of British forces on the outskirts of town. The German commander only just eluded capture, as the British were slowed by street-to-street fighting. "The strangest thing of all," an Indian soldier wrote home, "was that some of the enemy's aeroplanes were captured here, that is, in Nazareth, with their airmen, that is to say, the cavalry proved themselves skillful enough to catch birds with their hands." After meeting determined resistance, the British secured Nazareth on 21 September. By the third day of operations, British forces had captured the key towns in the Palestinian hill country and taken control of the main railway bridge over the Jordan River at Jizr el-Majami. Having cut every escape route from the West Bank to Transjordan, the British began to accept the surrender of tens of thousands of Turkish soldiers from the 7th and 8th armies, both of which were defunct by 21 September. All that remained to complete the conquest of Palestine was to secure the northern ports of Acre and Haifa, which fell to British and Indian cavalry on 23 September. With Palestine securely in British hands, Allenby now turned to Transjordan. The New Zealand Mounted Brigade rapidly secured Salt, 23 September, and Amman, 25 September. The 4,000-man garrison in Mahan, ordered to withdraw to Amman as part of a last-ditch attempt to